Hello and welcome to All the Best Pictures. It's the spin-off of our normal podcast where we watch all the Best Picture winners from the start. And God, it's still the 1930s. Please send help. Please send help. Save me from this bad man who keeps making me watch these black and white movies. Hey, Dave.
Positivity there, Sam. Oh, just a little tip. If someone who watches so many 30s movies, we move past that when we go into the talkies. We move past that doing a whole sentence on the one in draw of breath. Super weird sound. Like the, hello, my name's Sam. You know.
Obviously, what's happening, Dave, is that I'm a silent movie star who has not adapted well to the talkies.
You've got the silent movies. I will give you that.
Well, I'll take that, I think. That's good, I think, isn't it? But not necessarily the voice or the cadence or the ability to charisma, acting. Yeah, it's hard. So welcome to this podcast. I'm absolutely delighted to be here for. There's your fucking positivity, Dave.
Where this week... How many films have we done now?
We have done, I think this is... Is this five? I think we've done five. So we're watching
Wings,
All the Best Pictures.
Broadway Melody.
Yes. Keep going.
On the Western Front. And
yep.
Cimarron. So I think this is number
Cimarron.
Five.
This is number five from 1932, which means it's the 1932
Oscars.
These were the
dark times. There wasn't a good
movie in sight. It's
and the Hays Code is coming like a fucking freight train. I can only imagine it's going to get worse before it gets better.
The movie we did was Grand Hotel, which is a remake of a play, and very much a remake, I think, is the right way of describing this, because it may as well just be on a stage the entire time, because
the premise
sweet
I like.
Jesus.
I like the, because you've seen a million films like this done better. The premise of especially setting a film or the TV show, the White Lotus recently, is a TV show set in a hotel. And
yes,
it allows you to have these transient like characters in a way that you can't have in a more static like scenario, because it's this big meeting place of people coming and going, and there really is something there. And I can imagine the play is really entertaining. However, I think a lot of it gets lost in the shuffle with the film.
We may be seeing
the infancy of the genre, I think.
I think so, but interestingly, and you talked about All Quiet on the Western Front and to a lesser extent Wings and the other films we've done, I don't think necessarily fit my point, but really in those two examples we've seen, I think, films that surprised us by actually how well developed they were and how much they felt like movies that we could like recommend. Like All Quiet on the Western Front, I could absolutely recommend to someone who's a bit into movies already but not that much, and say you're going to sit down in 2024, you know, 100 years later or 90 years later, and just absolutely enjoy this. Whereas, you know, when it comes to a movie like this, I think you really suffer from just not being in that time and not having the contemporary connection to how movies are made, how stories are told, because so much of this, I really struggled to connect to.
It's a departure from the other movies we've done for this show. Every other film we've done is a film starring mostly nobody, but telling a fairly cohesive story, largely. Mm-hmm. Whereas this is a film starring everybody. It's all the stars, mostly doing very little. And
yeah,
it's sort of like a pre... Ocean's 11 is the film that's mentioned on the Wikipedia article. As basic as possible. The original Ocean's 11, I mean, and then obviously the
Where's Brad Pitt?
Is similar, exactly. But like the Expendables, like any star vehicle, any sort of film where you just get like 10 of the biggest celebrities you can get on board. Love Actually, great example of this. Like,
oh yes, or
you know, loads of little stories,
Valentine's
little
Day,
semi-connected stories. Yeah,
yes, and, those and, horrible and movies.
Exactly, but I think that when you have so many stars in the movie, and obviously it must have been worse in 1932, you have so many stars in the movie, it kind of distracts from it being really good cinematography, or it being really innovative, or it being really like well written, because actually the most important factor in films like this is scheduling it, so all of these incredibly busy, like, important stars can be on set at the same time, and that becomes the overriding, like, fact in your film.
And, you know, some of them in this movie aren't from the Barrymore family either, because there's
one or two here or there
just rocking up. Yes, that's right, listener, as in Drew Barrymore. She's a fucking Nepo baby. She's a Nepo great-grandbaby, I think.
She's like a Nepo baby squared. Did you know, Sam, that Drew Barrymore's name is just two surnames from her family?
Excellent.
Like, it's her grandmother's maiden name is Drew. And so her name is just surname.
Barrymore. That's Barry Johnson, Barrymore. Johnson. Oh, yeah. I would please. There must be
Barrymore the third.
In the Barrymore family, there must be. Right, Dave, before we get into this movie, I think we've kind of shared, I think, where we're at. Let's talk about 1932, because I think, as well as exploring the movies at the time, let's get into all the other things that are happening. Now, unfortunately, because it's the 30s, it's pretty bad. It's a pretty bad thing. And the first thing that I want to talk about, February the 25th, Adolf Hitler obtains German citizenship and naturalization to be able to run for the German presidential election, which doesn't happen until next year. But boy, at the start of the year,
used all kinds of illegal methods to do so.
Yeah, this is like we're
just in case you had any questions about the morality of Adolf Hitler, lingering questions.
Well, what's his deal? Is he a good guy, a bad guy? It's hard to know, isn't it? I think probably ask half the internet,
clip
and that would be the genuine response
for future use.
Yeah, there we go. Oh, also, and in sad news, but also like huge pop culture props, the Lindbergh baby goes missing. That's right. The infant
this
son of Anne
reference
and Charles Lindbergh.
The Simpsons. I think Mr. Yes. Burns accuses someone of being the Lindbergh baby. It's funny because it's a joke from the 90s about something that happened 50 years earlier that we're now laughing at 30 years after that.
Written by people who got the reference from their parents. Like, that's how far away we are. But the Lindbergh baby, if you don't know, is Charles Lindbergh was a famous aviator, and his wife was as well. And the baby was stolen. Charles Lindbergh was stolen
kidnapped.
And murdered. Yes, kidnapped. And from March until May, they were missing until someone found him, which is very sad. It's a very sad thing. But certainly left its, I think, impact on pop culture.
Cultural impact, yeah. Definitely kidnapping.
Here's something you don't want to do. Want to get a Zeppelin from Germany to South America? Absolutely not.
A giant balloon full of hydrogen? Absolutely, yes. I can imagine that would go really well.
The LZ-127 Graf Zeppelin starts flying, and I just think, what the fuck? Zeppelins, you are. When is the the humanity thing? Because I think that's probably a good end point of where we're going. I'm kind of done with Zeppelins. Kind of done not doing that, you know, anymore.
Yeah, let's stop making, like, essentially a giant bomb and then flying it through the air. The petrol-driven engine.
The ship itself retired in 1937. So we were with 17,000 flight hours. That's pretty intense. May Goofy makes his appearance in the Disney animated short Mickey's Review. So Goofy's going to be coming back at some point, probably. And then just a few days later, the Dow Jones Industrial Average in the United States reaches its lowest level of the Great Depression. Fantastic. So Mickey's back. Goofy's with us in Mickey Mouse, and the Depression is raging on. And to finish, and this is... No, well, actually, one more thing. Roosevelt wins the election in November. John Williams is born. And then to finish, the Emu War begins in Australia. Now, have you heard of this one, Dave? Have you heard of the Emu War?
I have heard of the Emu War, yeah.
Which is basically the Americans... the Australians went to war against a large flightless bird because they were, like, taking over and...
Destroying crops, I think.
And basically I like the idea of it being a war, and thus the Australians lost. They, Australia can't even kill emus. That's right, Australia. What a bunch of losers, because you tried to wipe out this flightless bird. A flightless bird,
we were
ladies and gentlemen.
You didn't think we were going to watch a 1932 Hollywood movie and not attack Australia, did you?
Yeah, take that. You couldn't even kill birds that are fixed to the ground. I mean, how difficult could it be? You've got machine guns. You've got high explosives. How hard could it be? And yeah, after several attempts, they tried to kill them. It didn't work. And then basically they just kept on breeding and they were absolutely fine. So
yeah,
here's a nice little
well,
stat.
That's a lesson, really, that you know, if you can't win a war against a giant flightless bird, maybe reassess your strategic operations.
Yeah, what a bunch of losers. Anyway, let's get on with the movie.
The Grand Hotel.
In the Grand,
so
I'm
what
just going to do
in
a,
this movie. Oh, you're doing
well.
Doing
plot synopsis. I'll give you the IMDb thing, which is a group of very different individuals staying at a luxurious hotel in Berlin deal with each of their respective dramas. Now, most of the time, I'd be like, "Fucking hell, IMDb, you really blew it on that one." However, this is kind of like a Netflix 10-part series, but it's the 30s, because a lot of these stories
Netflix 10-part series, like, condensed into 2 hours.
2 hours, yeah. But a lot of these stories are kind of like individual stories. I mean, they do interconnect in places, and some of the characters have those kind of, like, interpersonal relationships. But really, a lot of this shit is just running in parallel, and it culminates, you know, at a certain point. But really, like, this is just almost taking a camera inside a hotel and filming all the weirdos who are hanging around.
Yeah, it's not very cohesive, really. So we've got the Barrymores, obviously. John Barrymore plays the Baron. Leonard Barrymore? Lionel Barrymore.
John Barrymore as
Krugerlein, the accountant. I really liked his performance. I think it's probably one of the better ones in the movie. So you've got the Baron, you've got Krugerlein, who's the accountant, who's dying. You've got Flem, that's the name they use. Joan Crawford, who is a not a secretary, she's a
stenographer.
You've got the industrialist, who is an actor I recognised, but I can't remember his name off the top of my head.
Wallace Beery.
And then you've got Greta Garbo, and that's kind of it for your characters, really. Like, for your main characters, there's others, but those are the people we're focusing on.
Yeah, let's go through each one of them, and not necessarily, we can talk about the performances, but in terms of, like, their plot line through the film, because the culmination is kind of not important. The one that interested me most, so let's start there, and I think you're agreeing with me, is Lionel Barrymore as Otto Krugerlein, who's this kind of weird, slightly campy,
Weasley, nerdy,
socially
the subtext is this guy doesn't fuck, essentially, would be that, you know, he's a bit like, he's nervous
he's
around
he's quite
women.
Infantilized.
He's never danced in public, he doesn't drink, yeah.
And his kind of role in the movie is his kind of arc is that he's dying, or he thinks he's dying anyway, and it's not really clear whether or not he's properly unwell, but he thinks that's it, and so he's got to take it as,
because the movie never refutes it. He gets some bad news at the beginning of the movie, and basically I think he's told you've got weeks to live. So he resolves to stay at this really posh hotel and get shit-faced for the whole rest of his life. And I'm like, well, I applaud that, I suppose.
The days that are that. But he's also not really experienced much life, is he? Because he's kind of, and I think the thing that he discovers through the movie is that actually, with all of the other folks, which we'll get to in a second, he rediscovers or discovers actually that there are that you know, a bit more of a gregarious way of living, and he's drinking lots and he's gambling and he's, you know, trying to.
Well, he says kind of, he has a good speech, I think. I've not written it down, but he had a good speech in the middle of the movie, which is kind of like, I've scrimped, I've worked hard, I did everything right, I've worked hard and I've scrimped and I've saved. all of my life and live frugally and well, and now I'm dying and I've got nothing to show for it. And he actually works for the industrialist, which is an important way that it intersects. And
yeah,
like, he's just treated like shit. He's underpaid, like overworked, and you know, it's all kind of written as like a, well, what was it all for? So I'm just going to essentially do loads of cocaine. Although it's the 30s, so it's chilled champagne, I suppose.
It's expensive champagne. Yeah, this is the... I mean, I got to say,
he's going to gamble and he's going to dance and he's going to, you know...
And if I'm hopefully not dying, but let's say if I'm a bachelor with plenty of cash, this is the life that I want. I just want to sit in a hotel, hang around in hotels the rest of my life, become a filthy, degenerate alcoholic, and just be, you know, like, just be a charming fixture of the grand hotel. Like, that's a fun kind of way to live. And he's definitely a character, isn't he? And the movie treats him like a bit of a character. All the other actors are kind of other characters are kind of, they kind of pity him a bit, don't they? Because he is he's a little pathetic and he's a little weaselly, like you say.
It's a mixture of like pity and dismissal, I think. I think that maybe does turn throughout the movie. Let's talk about the Baron next, I think.
Baron.
It's like the other
John
Barrymore.
Let's talk
about our second Barrymore. And he plays an impoverished Baron. I don't really know what standing that had in Germany in 1932, but he's an impoverished Baron who is occasionally a jewel thief, and is, we don't get a lot about this, but he's in with some sort of criminal organization within Berlin, and he's in the hotel seemingly to kind of live it up, and we see him breaking into several rooms. He's there to fleece the inhabitants of the hotel.
Yeah. But he's not very good at it, is he? Because
he keeps getting caught.
Well, but he also gives up. He could, as he kind of interacts with Greta Garbo, steal all of her jewels and diamonds and necklaces, and he says no. And
The arc is kind of that, like, he doesn't rob Greta Garbo because he falls in love with her, which in the 1932 means that he met her, he was attracted to her, and then he had sex with her, and therefore he was in love with her.
That's
what they teach you in the academy.
But
similarly, he, I think, develops like actually a respect for Krugelein, and it might be a pity, but I think that he genuinely likes him, and therefore doesn't rob him because he feels guilty about it.
Well, he does rob him. He does rob him because he steals his pocketbook with 14,000 marks in it. But then when Krugelein wakes up and is all distraught because he's lost it, and that's all of his money, which is again a bit of a thing of like, so are you really a rich weirdo or not? Like, apparently not. But he gives it back because he's so upset. So I think there's like a moral core that runs through this. Krugelein is definitely on that good side, and the Baron is kind of in the middle.
Yeah.
And I think the movie's intentionally trying to kind of like present those. Go on.
I was just going to say, I mean, the only really relevant thing is his interaction with Greta Garbo, really, and Joan Crawford. And they have because they have quite a lot of scenes together. The Baron's sort of because I assume because of scheduling, Garbo doesn't really interact with anybody else in the movie but John Barrymore.
Yeah.
Whereas John Barrymore has scenes with every other major character.
With everyone else. Let's talk about Greta Garbo then as Grishinkaya, who is a like Russian ballet dancer, basically.
Do you know what? Like, as much as Greta Garbo is like one of the most famous actresses to ever live, like, you could take her out of this movie and it doesn't change a goddamn thing.
Well, that's a good point, Dave. I tend to agree. I think this is probably the weakest character for me because... she doesn't really have a lot to do other than kind of the Greta Garbo overly dramatic, kind of miserable, you know, vindictive, but also very loving. And oh, let's go away. Let's get on the train. Let's me and you.
She's
it's just
doing
me
the
and
Sunset
you.
Boulevard thing, Sam.
Exactly, which is kind of what like
manic,
which is
starlet.
Well, Manic Pixie Dream Girl before that was a thing, yeah. Isn't it? It completely is this. And I just think, yeah, I don't really like where that performance fits in this movie, because I think you end up not really... I didn't really connect with her.
Having her not interact with the other characters. If you introduce her to the ecosystem, which has Joan Crawford, who is a stone cold fox. Sorry, Greta Garbo, but Joan Crawford and the Baron and the industrialist and Lionel Barrymore. Like, I think if you introduce her to that circle as this, like, and you know, Kruger Lion can be like obsessed with her but terrified of her, and he can't talk in front of her, and he's just intimidated because she's just got this like raw sexuality because she's a dancer, and this exotic thing because she's Russian. And you could have all of that. You could have the industrialist maybe like think that he could, she could be a conquest, but then like deciding that he dislikes her because she's rejected him. You could work it in. Like the miniseries you and I could write about these characters and these actors appearing in a story would be really, really good. And I think that's where the fact that the play was successful comes from, because I think actually the bones of this is very good. But when you have a character in your movie and she has three scenes with one of the other characters and that's it, like, you just can't, it's disjointed.
It feels detached. Are you listening, Netflix? Are you listening to this Prime Analysis? All right, we are for sale.
They'll pay anyone, price. Please, Netflix.
Yeah, I think we're going to miss that ship. Let's talk about then Joan Crawford, who, stenographer, I think this performance I love. She's so fun and she's punchy and she's, as you say, Dave, she interconnects with the rest of the characters, and her job is...
The best thing about this movie, I really do think.
I completely agree.
She's got charisma on screen. And like you said, she's a stenographer, and when we first meet her, it's kind of this... She's smoking. We talked about women smoking in movies.
Outrageous.
Broadway Melody. Because it's still a bit a taboo at this point, like in history. And
it's literally Edward Bernays' sort of Torches of Freedom. They are fucking doing this on purpose to make women smoke because, hey, 50% of the population have money too. Crazy. Google it.
Yeah. But so she's a bit, she's funny, like you said. She's got a real sense of humor, the character in this movie. She kind of plays off the fact that she's more working class than the industrialist and the Baron, but she's sort of, so you know, she inherently, I think, connects more with Lionel Barrymore initially.
The Baron.
She's also really attractive, and that kind of puts everyone on the back foot because she's a stenographer. And we kind of, what does the industrialist say to her? You're good looking enough that you could do another job. And it's like the subtext isn't, well, sex work, but that's certainly like, oh, you don't have to be a stenographer. You could do other work.
I have to say, I mean, the way that women are treated in this movie, especially Joan Crawford, a little bit less with Greta Garbo, because she's got quite a lot of power. But she's also rich, isn't she? And she's a star, so she can. Whereas Joan Crawford is treated, and I have to say, the Baron is probably the worst one of this, because he just like attaches himself to her like a fucking limpet, and is some of the shit. What was the line? I can't quite remember. It's something to do with dictation, and I'm just like, oh no, don't say that.
It's really creepy. Please. And the worst thing about it, I think, is the fact that it's just like, it's not even like Joan Crawford is like particularly outraged by his behaviour, because it's so normal. And like,
it's, you know what? I'm always fucking shocked by this. I mean, I'll give you the line. I don't suppose you'd take any dictation from me sometime. I'm like, please, for the love of Jesus. It must have been, and it must continue to be, fucking exhausting being a woman and having to deal with all of this fucking innuendo. I'm here to do a fucking job. I've seen a guy naked. I've had this Baron, so-called, fucking hitting on me about my job. And we've also got, like, just endless array of men walking everywhere. Everywhere. Jesus.
We do get a cool moment where she stands up for herself, not as a woman, but as a working class person. When, what's the industrialist name? Because I keep just calling him an industrialist. And
the industrialist is Prasing. General Director Prasing. Wallace Beery.
Is like, basically just has a flap because of what's going on in his storyline, which we'll get to in a minute. And just tells her to go, and she's like, listen, mate, am I working tomorrow? And he's like, oh, well, and she's like, no, you need to let me know if I'm not working here tomorrow, because I will have to work somewhere else. Like, and she puts him in his place a little bit and says, you know, I just can't afford to just be standing around waiting.
Just lolling around waiting for you,
on the
mate.
Off chance fucking... that I'll have something to type.
Yeah. Well, and this is, and I don't particularly want to get deep into it because it's kind of not important, but.
We can't really fix the 1930s sexism,
no.
I'm afraid.
No, well, that yeah, that as well. But
2030
so Wallace...
sexism, that's coming up.
Yeah, we'll get there. Wallace Beery as General Director Pracing. Let's get into him, because his story is something to do with, Dave, I don't want a fucking 40-minute explanation from you because you've Googled it. He's basically, his business is failing, and so he's trying to merge with another business, but he needs something to do with some people in Manchester, which is fucking odd. Why Manchester? That's weird. And then
it just seems
they're
like
gonna,
some sort of tick box X to say that you've got...
He's trying to do
whoever's
something.
In Manchester... These German companies, they want your shit, basically. They love your shit, and they cannot wait to get their hands on it. And so this company doesn't want to merge with him, really. They're meeting with him, but polite out of politeness. Until he lies to them and tells them he's got this agreement with this London, with this Manchester company. And it's just a MacGuffin, isn't it? And then they're like, oh, absolutely, we'll merge with your company. That's fine. If you've got that, that's something we want. And that's fine, isn't it? But that's the whole
thing. It's almost
thing.
Like... The backup,
it's a house,
isn't it? To get
it's
this
the
deal.
Business house of cards, and it's nice to know that existed in the 30s, just like it exists now. Of like, this guy's basically trying to stay ahead of his creditors, basically.
Yeah, and that's kind of so. The motivation for him is to secure this deal, and the stenographer's kind of part of that in terms of being, you know, part of the business arrangements.
He wants to secure that deal. That's for sure.
Fucking Jesus! It must
There's
have been
a very
so
blunt
tiring
conversation when he says, "I'm going to have to go to Manchester. I'd like you to come with me." And she's like, "For stenography? Nope." She doesn't even say that. She's like, "How much would that be?" It's kind of like a very tacit, like, "You want to come on a trip to Manchester and suck my dick or what?"
Yeah, like for fuck's sake, honestly. Honestly, I apologize, women. This is just exhausting. I'm just so tired already just watching this. So, and this is where I actually, as you say, in terms of our Netflix miniseries coming in 2025, thanks Netflix, I think I'm quite interested in this. And I think if you're starting in your head to recast it, perhaps, and think, who could we get as this? And this would be really fun. And like, you know, he's obviously dead, but I'm still Ian Holm as what's his face as fuck's sake, where's he gone? Krieglein, you know, Ian Holm as a kind of Krieglein character.
Yeah, you could recast and this with the same characters and the same basic backstory, and just like,
let it run. Just let it run.
Write some decent dialogue for these people, and have like, you'd have the episode 10-episode limited series, and you'd have this business deal, you'd have that unfold over several episodes, and every episode would maybe focus on one of the characters more than the others, and then you'd have the big sort of like everything coming together at the end. And then I like the final scene of like, oh, we see all sorts at the Grand Hotel. I love that as like an idea for an anthology sort of thing. And that's what The White Lotus, basically, if you've not seen it, it's basically that idea.
Yeah. And even at the start, we get the switchboard, you know, stuff, which I think that's a great example.
Ask grandparents about that.
Yeah, that's a great example though of something that must have been quite innovative at the time to see, you know, from above, or from below. Either way, you're not looking at the women; you're looking at the switchboard, and it's just panning around, and it stops when we get to the key phone call that kicks off the story. So all of this is really fun, and I think a lot of the way through this movie, I'm kind of bored, and I'm still not quite sure whether or not that's just because it's a 1930s movie and it's hard work sometimes, or if it's because, and I think you probably have an answer here, Dave, if it's because actually the way that they try and tell these individual stories is good, but as soon as they try and connect them together, which it just becomes tiresome. It just becomes really like, okay.
It's stagey, and it's what works on a stage where you've got a captive audience in a theatre, and basically the whole thing is a series of monologues and like not a lot of actual physicality, and this movie kind of lacks any of that physicality. And I'm not talking about fights, I'm not talking about blown up buildings, I'm talking about mostly this has got that old movie thing of people standing still in a room and talking to each other, which is fine. But like, look at a movie like Rope, for instance, is the inverse of this, where someone looked at that and said, right, we're going to have all these people stood in one room. How can we make it visually interesting? Like, how can we make it visually interesting watching these people sit and have dinner? And this movie is the opposite of that, where it's like, it's just shooting the scenes and it's all very static in that way. I'm not saying the cinematography is bad. What I'm saying is that they don't go out of their way to keep you attentive by having movement. And like, so most of the scenes are kind of like flashing between camera A and camera B, like the scene where they're gambling. Like, it's just camera A, camera B, camera A, camera B, and there's not a lot to it.
Can I just provide some context for the listener? If you've not seen Rope, 1948, Alfred Hitchcock film.
That's our episode on Rope.
What are you doing with your life, you saddo? Go see Rope. No, it's not an amazing movie.
I would love to be in a relatively small room, Sam, with everybody who's really into Rope in the entire world. Like me, you, and probably 60 other people.
60, I know, yeah. But so I think what you're saying, though, in terms of, is that in that movie, we get lots of movement. The sets move. And it's kind of treated more like a play, where literally sets lift up and they come down, because the film is intentionally, from Hitchcock, trying to kind of mirror those old, you know, the kind of the theatre styles. Where in this movie, what we get is a very famous play, and a very, very well trodden play. It had been on, you know, been around for a long time, very popular. And so I think, in some ways, I think a lot of people probably would already know this story. And so when they wrote the screenplay, or when they transferred it from, you know, the playbook to the to a script, a movie script, I think they just kind of transferred it quite literally and didn't really consider, because it's the 30s as well, that actually there might be more innovative things we could do here. Now, I compare that to a movie which I talk about quite a lot, because it's, you know, kind of probably the prime example of maybe the best movie ever made, Citizen Kane, 1941. It's later, right? But compare and contrast the movement. It feels like we're watching movies. You know, even just a decade later, we have advanced a heck of a long way. And so I think we do have to give the film a little bit of credit and a little bit of leeway to say,
and
you know,
to be positive,
there's a lot to happen.
I did enjoy this movie.
Yeah.
Like, generally, I wasn't, like you said, there's a real bit in the middle where I was less than enthralled, and there's lots of faults with it, but this isn't as bad as like Cimarron or Broadway Melody, which were like much less interesting and much less entertaining and much less well shot.
And massive in scale. Cimarron's a fucking huge movie. You know, like thousands of horses died
to
bring you this
film.
There's
loads to look at in that movie, but there's fuck all going on. Whereas in this movie, there's nothing to look at, but there's quite a lot like stagey, conversation-y stuff going on, which I'm not like against at all. And I like the performances. And that's, I think, the lasting thing in this movie, is that it's a star vehicle. And that held sway over every other fact about this movie, was that this has got like six of the highest earning like celebrities, actors in one movie, which was certainly not the norm for this era at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's talk about how this progresses. So we've got all of these characters running through, and the Baron and, God, all these fucking character names. The Baron and the stenographer, Joan Crawford, they kind of have this... It feels a bit romantic at the start. Phlegm, yeah. And then that falls away and it becomes a bit more kind of just...
It's a bit more collegiate, isn't it? In, I don't know.
Yeah, because I think they recognise that...
They're quite pally. They're quite friendly and pally. And he wants her to dance with Kriegerline because he's basically just like, oh, he's a sad sack and... You know, it probably
you're a woman,
give him a bone
so
for the rest
do something,
of his life
woman.
If you dance with him, Joan Crawford, and she's like, yeah, all right.
Yeah. The Baron and the ballerina, they're going to kind of run away together. That's kind of the thing, isn't it? And at the end of the movie, Greta Garbo is rushing around trying to find the Baron, except
nobody
shock horror.
Will tell her.
Nobody will tell her that the Baron has been killed. Trying to steal money from the industrialist.
Well, that's interesting. I actually like that last scene because he gets killed, and we don't sort of, we'll get into that scene in a sec. But when Garbo leaves, because it's literally the last thing she does in the movie and the only important thing, we get this wonderful scene of like sort of incidentally, the staff don't tell her that the Baron's dead, and her staff don't tell her.
Where's the Baron? Because he's gone. Is the Baron here? No. And that is they don't say any more than that. They don't lie. They just lie with admission, you know.
Yeah, but her people, like the stage manager and her manager and her maid, don't tell her because, like, when her and the Baron fall in love, by which I mean meet once and have sex, that's what they teach at the academy. She's going to kill herself. She's depressed. Her star is not rising anymore. Her career is on a downswing, because she's 26 or whatever the line, completely accurate line in this movie is. Something's changing. Something stay the same. So she's going to kill herself. And meeting the Baron and falling in love with him is kind of what reinvigorates her. And she goes out and has the best show she's ever had. She's got this residence in Vienna. So her staff are saying, they can't tell her he's dead because they think she'll go and blow her brains out. So, but the way that the movie, I love the way the movie just leaves that hanging. She just gets in the car and drives away, and we don't have to have the whole I do like that.
The scene after, because her career is kind of on the wane, isn't it? She's struggling a little bit because she's fucking dramatic and probably a pain in the ass. You know what I mean? Like she's
well, also
really
like I said,
that.
Like I wasn't being too flippant, but. You know, she's 26, so you know her career as a dancer is very much like on the wane.
It's on the air. So then, Joan Crawford's character and the director Preysen, we'll get the Krieg line in a second, because they're now like he's off to Manchester because he says to the other Germans who he's trying to secure the merger with, I've got it. I've sorted it. Manchester's done. It's no problem. Everything's fine. Except it hasn't. And he hasn't got the deal. So now he needs to go to Manchester to secure the deal. Otherwise, like it's kind of farcical in that way. And he's playing this quite comedic. And so then Joan Crawford's going to go with him for stenography. Funny. Yeah. Which is definitely what she's going to be doing.
For a thousand
they
marks,
kind of push him as.
They don't even really talk about stenography. She's basically.
No, I'm being facetious. I'm being facetious. Yeah. They kind of play him as this like romantic character, and he's kind of smoozing a little bit, and she's pretending, I think, to find him attractive in order to kind of secure her deal, which again goes to my kind of like grifter, a bit like the Baron, which is I think why they connect and they have more of an equal relationship. They're kind of recognizing each other, don't they? That and then, and I think we've covered all of the main characters, and there are a few others, but God, who has time? And then we get the kind of final part of Krieglein's character, and once the Baron's dead and the businessman did it with the lead pipe in the hotel room. She runs to the Krieglein and says, it's a terrible thing. Oh, it's terrible. Oh, you must go see the Baron. And basically, does he get arrested? The businessman does?
Yeah, he does.
Preysen gets arrested. And so Joan Crawford.
He's a little bit in shock as well. It's a cool, like, little performance where
because the Baron
asking,
was stealing from him, he was going to steal from
well,
him. So
yeah, but what I mean is he kind of like he recognizes he's ruined his life because he's murdered a man, and he's kind of in shock. Like he's are these handcuffs really necessary? And do we really have to go to the police station? I've got to be in Manchester, and they're like, you killed somebody, and he's like,
buddy, this isn't, I'd stop talking. Don't talk to cops. Just don't talk to the police, okay? Never talk to the police. He's fine, yeah.
Especially in 1932 Germany. Watch out, man.
Oh, I so want to talk about that in a second. So, and so then, so Joan Crawford then and Lionel Barrymore as Kugelheim, like, basically, this pathetic loser who's completely manages to get away with the girl, manages to leave, like, and he's gonna, he's
she
got
wants,
15...
She just wants to go. She just wants to be away from it. And he's she like, wants to be away yeah, from I'll, go it. To I'll go to Paris. I'll be dead in six this weeks guy, anyway. What do I care?
This guy's got money and he's gonna give me tickets to Paris. Fucking great. And so she's like, and so, right. And there's some things I want to talk about. You want to talk about a dead body, actually, before we go off this scene, before the murder? The fact
this
that we
like
never see...
Thing, doesn't it?
We never see the Baron's dead body. Even, we don't even see his face. They say, he's still got his eyes open. Like, but we never see it because it's the 30s, I guess, and that's too much, you know. So
yeah,
that's interesting.
It's a bit of a weird one.
The other thing, before we get to the Nazis, is... that, you know, despite actually going through this and feeling rather bored at points, I'm really impressed by actually how the characters are presented, because when we're talking about this, I'm kind of ringing off these characters and I'm actually quite invested, and I'm able to recall and connect how these characters are interacting with each other. And I think it's another example of whereas have we said, like, this movie is very kind of retrograde in a lot of ways. It goes to that central point that movie making is incredible, because a film from, you know, you're pushing 100 years nearly, can still elicit this type of emotional interpersonal connection and these relationships. And it feels so real, even though it's heightened, even though we're not getting gritty 1970s Al Pacino movie vibes from this, it's still very, hey, sweetheart, like, but fucking movies, man, like, fucking movies. I love the way that these characters have left an impression on me, and that I think is maybe the takeaway from this, you know.
Well, that's your star power, and that's I think what we've missed from some of our more recent movies is,
yeah,
it's kind of maybe these are some of the biggest actors of their day, and continue to be for most of the next decade, a lot of them as well. And, you know, is this the golden age of Hollywood, I think, is the sort of the era we're
yes.
in? And
we're in the golden,
like,
age.
There's a
yeah.
reason these people were stars, is because they've just got this screen charisma. Every one of the main characters in this movie, like you said, is characterizing something. And even a lot of movies today, we don't, isn't necessarily true. Yes, it could have had a more interesting premise. The Best Picture winner is such a weird category. It's kind of what spurred this whole podcast. And because quite frequently it's not the best picture, that's kind of like a contradiction of, like, you know, and this feels like it was the best picture because it was the first big movie to star six, like, you know, six of the top 10 actors at that time. And so that it got Best Picture because that was really innovative in of itself.
And it was, I think, is it the only, or maybe one of only two films to be only nominated for the Best Picture Award? So it didn't get Best Sound. It didn't get Best Screenwriting.
It's the only Best Picture, I think. What was it? It's the only Best Picture to not be nominated for any other awards. It was only nominated for the Best Picture.
Nominated,
which it won.
Yeah.
And it's one of only three films not to win any other awards but Best Picture, the other two being Mutiny on the Bounty and Broadway Melody. Mutiny on the Bounty is coming up, so don't worry about that. We'll get that's 1935.
Yeah. God, it's the 30s, fucking Jesus.
Yeah, but, like, it's just, again, it's one of these things where the voting's a bit odd, and it will continue to be. And more recent movies we can point to and say, well, that how is that film the Best Picture? That the X film was robbed, and that film's dog shit. And that's still the case, because there's still a political aspect to the voting, and because it's all a bunch
what
of
do you mean?
White men, especially.
What do you mean? How did The King's Speech win the Academy Award for Best Picture in 2010? What do you mean? That makes no sense. That's not a really fucking boring, stale movie with stale, boring performances. Anyway, what about Argo? Oh, fucking Argo. Ooh. I mean,
actually,
honestly,
though, Films like that make you think, well, maybe the 30s aren't so bad.
Yes, actually.
At least this wasn't as long as the King's Speech.
Yes. And that's where I think, let's conclude in a second, actually, because I want to talk about the Nazis. Dave, right? The Baron, yeah? He's definitely a Nazi, right? It's 1932. We're fucking in Berlin. How many of these people are Nazis? I mean, I know the Nazis aren't quite, but they're about to be ascend into power. The SA has been kicking shit up for a long time already, and we're Hitler's just months away. The Baron especially has proper Nazi vibes to me. Yeah, he's like Donovan. He's like Donovan at the end of Last Crusade when he burns up and he's got a Nazi pin in his lapel. I can just fucking feel it.
Yeah, I kind of get that. And the industrialist as well. I think he's very much, especially when his business goes under, he's gonna be voting for the old H dog in that election.
Kroeglein less so. I think he's maybe a bit
be
more
dead
free
for
and...
a start. And who else have we got? We got the porter, head porter as a character, and the major. I think that guy who's got horrible World War One injuries.
Oh yeah, Jesus. Yeah, he's definitely upset about that and looking to channel it into. Completely harmless character who nothing bad will happen because of this guy.
Exactly. There we go. So I compiled a little bit of a list of, again, I think what I want to try and do this going forwards is just, I haven't seen any of these movies, but I'm going to read you some movies that sound more interesting than this. And I want to say, give me a yes or a no, whether you'll be interested. So movies from 1932 so some of these were nominated for Best Picture and lost to this movie. So Bad Girl was a 1932 movie which follows the courtship and marriage of two working class couples. That was nominated for Best Picture. It didn't win.
I think my interest is Pete.
The poster is quite raunchy. So take from that what you will.
What do you think I'm looking at right now, Dave? That's exactly...
This one actually was, out of all of them, I think this is probably the one that I was the most like, oh, wow, that sounds really interesting. But I know which one you'll think is really interesting. Emma, which is a movie about a housekeeper, an older woman, who you should Google the poster. A rich man dies and he leaves all of his money to his housekeeper, who he's been with them for over 20 years and then raised his children after his wife died. And the children take her to court for her money.
Wow.
And then when that doesn't work, they try to frame her for his murder. And actually it sounds like quite a positive sort of ending to the movie where they all agree to be friends and she gets another job as a housekeeper. Like, you're fucking poor people getting this place. But again,
she gets to be their housekeeper after them trying to
sue
her.
No, she gets another job as a housekeeper.
Another job, okay. Well,
after
that's
giving
still
them
bad.
The money. It's still bad, but it's an interesting movie starring somebody who's not traditionally attractive. And I think that's interesting.
Marie Dressler nominated. plays Emma, doesn't she? Yeah.
She was a really, really big star at this time. She was really big.
She died in 1934, age 65. Well, there we go.
Yeah. So the next one, this is the one that this has got Sam written all over it. So Emma was nominated as well for the Best Picture and didn't win. Helldivers from
this year. Oh, yeah, baby.
Which was not nominated, which is a naval aviation film made in conjunction with the Navy, which features a lot of footage of flight operations on the second aircraft carrier the USA ever had.
The Saratoga. Wow. I am so actually going to look this up and watch it.
Again, that doesn't that sound
fucking
cool?
Wallace Berry, who is in this movie.
Yeah.
And Clark Gable. In a fairly early Clark Gable performance. This looks brilliant. This looks absolutely brilliant. Look at that.
I've got two more. Which just
let's just read the Wikipedia page together. A total of 28 F-8C-4 aircraft were transferred to the US Marine Corps shortly after these helldivers. Wow, this looks brilliant. This looks so much fun. Okay, keep going.
Stay tuned. The other one was Five Star Final. Which is a film about the excesses of tabloid journalism. Doesn't that sound fun?
It kind of does. Edward G. Robinson.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Again.
Mm-hmm. Based off Snopes, a play, of course. This award. The 30s.
Shanghai Express. This one's a bit on the line.
Hold on a second. Before we move on from Five Star Final, newspaper publisher William Randolph Hearst was greatly offended by the film, which interpreted as a thing.
That fucker was offended by everything.
He retaliated by publishing negative reviews in the papers and pressuring theatres not to show the film. Again, genuinely, like, can I quit my job and this is just what we do all day? Listen, listeners,
Patreon.com. The more movies from 1932, I was like, yeah, that does sound really good.
That's great. That sounds great.
The last one was a hostage situation on a train. Always a good one. During the Chinese Civil War.
And what was the name of the movie, sorry?
Shanghai Express. My only concern is there's going to be a lot of white people in yellow face.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I mean, almost certainly.
But again, that was just five movies I picked out of the air. Like, some of them are obviously nominated for the Best Picture. It was just five movies that I picked out of that year. And I was like, wow, these all look really, really cool. And that's where I think this movie, The Grand Hotel, suffers at a distance of 90 years of like, yeah, but there were all these really cool movies out and then you gave the Best Picture to this one because it had Greta Garbo in it or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I think, God, I really want to watch this one as well.
Yeah.
Like, but you know, it shows you, just to your point earlier about how actually the Best Picture is a really poor measure, isn't it? And as we go into, you know, through this this series, which is going to take us several years to complete, it kind of makes you wish that we could watch every single one of these movies per episode. And so, and talk about the 1932 Oscars, you know, talk about the Best Picture.
Yeah.
Because really, we're not getting a sense. We're getting the Argos or we're getting the Gladiators. Fun movie, don't get me wrong. But in terms of like where that sits in the pantheon of 2000 films.
It's because the Best Picture really is the most zeitgeisty picture. It's really kind of like...
And it's the one that they can get
factors go into
Harvey
it,
Weinstein to fucking pitch for. You know, like that's where we're really at, isn't it? It's a power play. And it's disappointing that, but yeah, I mean, genuinely, the Shanghai Express Helldivers, I'm all up for. Less so Emma, because it sounds a bit depressing, but I'm having interesting thoughts about where we could try and
fit this into. I thought that aviation one would get you. I was like, wow, it does sound
100%. Look at that. Not just aviation, though, the Navy, like aircraft carriers fascinate me as well. So that's, to get like actual, wonderful propaganda, amazing propaganda. America's going to be kicking the shit out of everyone with these things in just 10 years. So let's fucking go, you know?
Exactly.
Well, there we go. I think once again, Dave, I fucking love doing this podcast with you because we get to enjoy.
In direct contrast to his statement at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah, because I think the discussion of it almost adds to the kind of the value of these movies, because you then get to explore, I think, all those different perspectives and all the other stuff, you know. And I think if we don't watch these movies, and I think this will probably get more. This will get easier to see as we progress and get closer to contemporary films. Is that you really start to see the connection between how movies were made in the past and how they're made now. And that to me is fascinating, to be able to kind of like see the links. And that's what I love about doing this, despite the fact we've got to watch a lot of shite sometimes.
Yeah, well, I've got a couple of ideas about how maybe we could just a slight tweaking of the format so we can maybe change the sheer weight of 1930s movies, maybe.
Just power through them all. We'll watch them all in one go and we'll talk about it in all one big 1930s mega cast. 10 hours of commercial-free 1930s movies starts now. just going to finish with a quote from the movie. Grand Hotel, always the same. People come, people go. Nothing ever happens. Just like this fucking movie. Let's go!